Welcome to Catholic Stuff You Should Know, the J10 Initiative.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
We have arrived.
We have. How is, as they say, never mind, I'm not going to say it. How was Aspen?
Aspen was good. It was restful. I was up there with Father Brian Larkin, the one and only. Your pastor, and he is doing well. He's resting. He's just reading and hanging out, and that's I was working on things.
Yeah.
And you were running the show down here.
That was, yeah. We brought 31 people into the church, which was awesome. So all the neophytes, they're running around now. They're going to different masses. They're receiving Eucharist, the Eucharist, which is so awesome. But it was great. It was a great treat to him.
Excellent.
Great Easter.
Yeah. Well, happy Easter to you. We're not gonna banter long here, folks, because we have somebody more interesting to talk to today than Father Sean and myself. But I do have a bit of news to tell you before we do it. This is right out of Matchbuff High School.
You're getting a new assignment.
No, I'm not. But Brendan McGarity's going to senior prom with Ella Swain.
Oh,
I just
big
got
news.
The photo.
Yes,
so, very exciting. These are friends of ours who are seniors. So congratulations to them. I told her I was going to give her a shout out and embarrass her. So
love it.
All right, so today we have the great joy of welcoming our friend and author, Megan Nix. But Nix is not your name anymore, is it?
Well, it's confusing. Okay. My legal last name is Weedle.
Weedle, yeah.
But everybody says Wydell when they see it.
Okay.
So I went with maiden name, which I had also published under before I was married. So it really just made sense to be Nix my book. Yeah.
Yeah, because you had begun your career prior to that.
Yes.
So we had the unfortunate situation of naming a podcast Remedies for Sorrow.
Yes.
Father, in January?
Deacon, yeah, something like that. Deacon Jacob and I did that one.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we were talking about that and we're like, guys, hey, what are you doing? You're jumping the gun. But this is the real one. That was just like the JV squad warming up. And today we're talking about Megan's book, Remedies for Sorrow, An Extraordinary Child, A Secret Kept from Pregnant Women, and A Mother's Pursuit of the Truth. And so this is just really fun for us and really different. And we're really grateful to have you on the podcast. We talked a little bit about what we wanted to do today, you and I. But I think we'll just start with just an introduction of just who you are and then moving into this book and how it came to be.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, guys. It's so cool to be here with you, and I'm so grateful. So the book is about our second daughter. We have five kids, my husband Luke and I, and we're Eastern Catholics. I actually met him. I was raised Roman Catholic, but met him in the Eastern Catholic Church, and that scene is actually in the book. Mm-hmm. And our second daughter, our first daughter was about two when we became pregnant with our second. And when she was born small for gestational age, it's called. She also had microcephaly, so her head was disproportionately small to her body, and she was totally silent when the midwife held her up in the delivery room. And even during pregnancy, I just had an intuitive feeling that something was different about her. And then as that first day with her went on, she did not pass her in-hospital hearing tests. And so there was this great mystery around her from the very beginning to see what would be revealed that maybe had a name, maybe didn't. And then eventually we found out that she had this disease that sort of broke open the whole industry of obstetrics for me and its lack of faith in mothers. And I knew I had to write a book both about motherhood and exposing her disease, which is actually preventable.
And that is, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So, I've had the privilege of reading this book. It's fantastic. Father Sean has read about half it. Okay, yeah. Megan you're a great writer.
Thank you.
And thanks I actually so had, so I read this book and then I was finishing up, they've heard about this on the podcast, but I'm finishing up my second book and I was in the throes of despair and the editing of tiny things in it, but I had like Megan Nix in my mind. I was like, would she use an M dash here? No, she would use a comma because M dashes are kind of cheating all the time.
Oh, but no, I love the M dash.
Oh, you do? Okay, okay,
I am all about M dash. I think I have to take out about half of what I'm inclined to put in.
Okay, I'm really happy to hear that because Hans Urs von Balthasar uses M dashes all the time. You know what we're talking about? This is super nerdy stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, the long one, not the hyphen. I didn't know there was a difference between a hyphen, an N dash, and an M dash until.
Yes, I found out about the N dash during editing.
Yeah.
Because I was like, what is this crazy thing you put in here?
Yeah.
After it was, you know, had gone basically to the printer.
All right, what's the difference between N dash and M dash? I don't know that distinction.
I think it's the length. Is that right? I think the N dash is a more of a British kind of usage. That's what I gathered. But
yeah, I'd have to look again. I think it's almost angled, isn't it? Isn't the N dash? And there's actually a totally different use than I was aware of. Now I don't even remember what it is. The M dash is the one that Word automatically corrects to a longer one if you put two dashes that like connects a thought to the next thought. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the general hyphen is just to say like, you know, whatever you want, high spirited, you would probably hyphenate.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure people are riveted by this conversation, but I'm actually,
let's talk about punctuation.
I'm actually very consoled because I have a couple friends who edit, and are always yelling at me for, they're like, you put 65 M dashes in this paragraph and this is just, you can't do this. So you use commas very well. That was the whole point of this.
Oh, thank you.
And I can tell you had to pull them out, but, I did have your prose and your style. Father Sean and I were just talking with Megan, and there's a level of vulnerability. This book is, would you describe it as a memoir? I mean, I know, like I saw some of the reading from the publisher on it. And it's just an amazing portrayal of motherhood and of suffering, through this disease, which we'll talk a little about, but really how this tied into Catholic stuff, was your spiritual kind of journey. And I would say even kind of conversion through it. I mean, not conversion in the sense of like that you weren't practicing, but just that you were able to articulate to a very, like a very prominent publisher, Doubleday, and to really be a faithful woman. I mean, I feel like your Byzantine Catholic faith was right at the heart of this book. And when we were in conversation, you were saying the editors at Doubleday, a secular press, were actually happy and appreciative of what you were kind of speaking about.
I was surprised. I thought when I submitted the book and I actually sold it on proposal, which means you give them this like 100-page pitch that's like, here's the book I want to write, here's why I should write it, here's a detailed chapter outline. So then when I had to turn in the pages, you know, they had bought it. And then when I had to turn in the pages, I'm like, do they know how Catholic this is going to be? And they wanted more. They were like, this is going to be really interesting to people. You know, just the faith aspect and the religious aspect, not necessarily the spiritual, but that there's actually broad interest in religion, which is different than culture would have you believe. And I was not going to dumb it down, but I thought that might need to be the case for me to secure a major publisher, and it wasn't. And I was so grateful. And actually my editor there, I had sold it under a different name, and I just had this one section in there about St. Thomas Aquinas's remedies for sorrow and how those had kind of applied to my, you know, journey with our daughter. And she was like, I think that should be the title for the whole book. And I was like, really? I don't know. I don't know how I can see that through the whole book. And she was like, I feel very strongly that it should. Mm. And it was a big change to make at the time. But I thought it was very telling that they would take this gamble, and I felt I was in good hands. You know, there is that feeling of like, okay, if I'm going to participate in the secular world's commercialism, is that going to hinder my ability to be as Catholic as I am? And in fact, it didn't. So
that's awesome.
It was great.
Yeah, it's great to hear. So I think that speaks a lot about just your talent as a writer, we're hoping that people buy this and read it and, can see that, but also just like you managed to break into the, I think kind of the secular world. And just as you described, like, it's not just religion is the problem, we want to throw it out, but people are actually hungry for this, a mm-hmm. deep spiritual interpretation of suffering, which you provide. And again, it was really balanced. It wasn't over the top. It wasn't over spiritual. It was just kind of like, this is what it looks like for a mother of faith to deal with real hardship. Mm. and real pain. You did that really well.
Thanks.
Yeah. Again, you did it through the lens of vulnerability. So we walked in here and Father John was just like, do you feel like you know everything about Megan now? Right. And it's like, thank you for that. Right. Thank you for the vulnerability. And it just gives us an insight, especially as men, of like what child labor is like and what giving birth is like and the beauty of that as a mother, which I think is so important. So I'm excited. I'm excited to dive more into it.
I also really enjoyed the just our conversations around writing. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that we have a lot of friends who have supported us over the years in publishing, and it's just a torturous process.
Yeah. I mean, it is very, it's actually more vulnerable than the writing indicates. Like, I could talk or write all day about the vulnerabilities of my life, but the vulnerability of the writing process itself is not very pretty.
Yeah.
You know, like the people around you. I mean, my husband, there were so many times where I was like, why am I even doing this? Right. This is terrible. Like, I would say as a writer, more often than not, you come away from the craft not happy with it.
Yeah.
And then when it does work, you know, I mean, thanks be to God, I really don't think it works without external influence, you know? I mean, sometimes you'll look back, I don't know if this happens to you with your writing, and it really doesn't feel like you wrote it. You're like, I don't remember writing that. That's pretty good.
Right.
You know, it was like divine inspiration or, you know, just an idea that is not of your own. And so, yeah, for me, there was a lot of vulnerability in the content, but a lot in the bookmaking itself, which is probably the case for you as I totally agree.
And it's just like, Luke sounds like, I mean, I've met Luke. It's been a lot of years. It's great to reconnect. And I look forward to seeing him again. But he sounds like just a very steady guy.
Yes, so. Annoyingly so.
Yeah, annoyingly steady. Yeah.
No, he's wonderful. And for sure, like throughout, the end of the book tells the story of how many times this book was rejected far and wide. And he just kept saying, it's gonna find a publisher. Like, yeah. You cannot stop writing it. You cannot move on to something else. You're going to find one. And it was very consoling. Sometimes I thought he was delusional, but I was like, he's pretty smart. He's pretty solid. I'm going to go with that and trust as he does.
Yeah. So. I mean, and that's the killer of it all is you go through these highs and lows where you have these moments of just like euphoric inspiration. And you're like, you don't think like this because you're more humble than I am, but you're like, I'm like, this is the most amazing thing ever. And then like the next day you sit down to write and you're like, this is a flaming pile of garbage.
Oh, totally. The same exact thing that you had been writing day to day looks 180 from itself. Yeah. It's a very bizarre process.
And I had been told when I was finishing the dissertation, somebody said to me, they're like, you don't ever finish books, you just abandon them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that. Yeah. And I'm sure that you've also, there are things of like, yeah, I would have done this differently. But also a sense of like this chapter of life kind of closed out. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I don't like to actually look at it anymore.
Yeah.
I'm fine talking about it. But a friend of mine asked recently if I had ever listened to the audio version, and I was like, no, and I never planned to.
Yeah.
I would say totally different things now, and you do. You just have to come to peace with it and be finished with it, because you'd revise the same book your whole life.
Right.
You know?
And then you just put the second version out there or whatever. did you record your own audio version?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I would, because I had read that it could be very emotionally taxing, and it takes like 8 to 9 hours in the studio, and you know, I have 5 little kids. But because I have a major publisher, they offered to pay me. And I decided to, I think there's something so authentic with nonfiction and with memoir, hearing the writer read it.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm listening to somebody's memoir and it's read by somebody else, it doesn't ring as true when it's an actress reading it, you know? And it was really nice. I recorded it in town here, and, you know, Penguin Random House, they have a contract with a studio here. And when I got there, I was like, you know, I've read a couple tips about how to do this and pace yourself. And the guys who were there, one of whom turns out I grew up in the same neighborhood with, and we like knew all the same people, but he said, you just be yourself. Like, the best way to do an audiobook is to just be natural. Don't think about any tips. And so that helped a lot. And it was very moving, actually. I think, you know, when you have said something in your head a lot, and then when you give a speech and you hear it through your ears, it can choke you up. there's something different about the way your heart feels through hearing than it does through thinking. And it's almost like, you know, somebody else is telling you your own story. So there were a lot of retakes where I had rewritten parts 50 times, but then, and it was very familiar to the point of feeling memorized, but I would utter it aloud and just like have to stop and retake because I was crying. And they were very compassionate and patient. And I think they see that a lot. You know, I think people who read their memoirs tend to cry. And
have your kids listened to it at all?
A little bit. I mean, usually they're with me and I'm like, turn it off. I don't want to, I don't want to hear myself. My oldest has read the whole book. She's 11.
Okay.
And it's totally, you know, appropriate for kids of that age. Some of the medical stuff was over her head, but she really liked it. And Anna, who it's about, she's 8 and she wants to read it. She's read little chunks of it, but, they've heard me, you know, on the radio and stuff and they get a kick out of it, but they've not listened to the full audio version.
Just out of curiosity, when people, you meet people who've read the book, because like one of the things we get sometimes on the podcast is like, because we do so much banter, is like people will come up to us and be like, remember that one time when you did this? It's like, you weren't with me, right? Like, don't act like you were there. So do you ever get people who are just like, because of your level of vulnerability and because of the stories that you're sharing, people are just like, remember that one time like when this happened? Or do you get much of that?
I'm not that famous.
Yes, you are.
Not really. I mean, I haven't gotten that question. People will bring things up that I wrote that I forgot about. And I find that so touching that they remembered something in the book. They haven't done it experientially, but I have a group of friends, a couple have read it twice and they're like, oh, this, you know, they'll quote it. I'm like, oh my gosh.
The difference is she's writing things that are profound. Our banter is nonsense and trivial.
That is true.
It's like, what'd you have for breakfast today or something like that? Which I made some great over easy eggs, but that's beside the point. One of the really beautiful things right out of the gun here is the dedication to your mother who passed away.
Was it
a year ago?
Yeah. So my book, the publication date was April 18th and my mom died April 3rd, very unexpectedly. She had melanoma and had started these infusion treatments and became sick in December. And I was pregnant with our 5th, book was coming out. Everything just felt like this beautiful Advent time expectation and joy. And then she got really sick and lost her mobility. And I had dedicated the book to her a year ago. You usually establish the dedication, you know, as you're finishing your final manuscript, which is a year to a year and a half before it's printed. And so it was really beautiful because she had read the whole thing in October before she got sick. After she was sick, her vision was messed up and, you know, she wouldn't have been able to read it. And so she had read it. And I think, that dedication, I felt it wholeheartedly when I dedicated it to her because she was just such a force in my life of maternalism and love and sacrifice. And then that became even more profoundly the case to lose her upon publication and have dedicated it to her life, essentially. And so the book itself, you know, it was a crazy time. It was like the confluence of these two major events that you don't want to have coincide. And yet it was like the book felt inconsequential after she died. I didn't even want to go to my book release party. And Luke was like, you have to. It was for her, you know. And so the book is like, it's like looking at grief and looking at love. And it's really like, because of how woven into it she was, it has made it more consequential than I would naturally be inclined to see it. Right now, I sort of wanted to just grieve. And I did for like 6 months after the book came out. I just sort of pushed aside publicity and just couldn't really do it. And I wanted to just be with my family and just feel my way through that sadness. And yet it's because of her. And, you know, of course my mom liked it better than anybody because she was my mom like the whole time. She's like, it's the best book I've ever read, you know? So everything that I do for the book is to honor her. And that does make it consequential again.
So. Yeah. And I think that someday when Anna does read this, it's just going to give that beautiful testimony to your mother. And it's a living gift. You know, we had talked about how dedicating a book to a parent, like, this is just a tremendous thing you can do, because it's, you're writing this for her and you're writing this about her, and it's, and she's in you, you know? And so Anna, and your other kids will be able to kind of receive that patrimony. So,
yeah, I haven't thought of that. I love that. And I think that's true, 'cause you wonder, like, what remnants of her they will hold on to. And that could be one of them.
Yeah, so. For sure. So Luke, sounds like quite a guy. Back to him for a second before we dive into some of the content of the book. He drags you up to Sitka, Alaska.
Yes.
Every summer.
Yes, he does, for better and for worse.
So Luke is from Denver, is that right?
Yeah, he is. Okay. Oh, well, Boulder.
From Boulder, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you're either driving the minivan or the black Tacoma out there with all the hunting stickers on it.
I'm in the black Tacoma, but nice. Our minivan's at home. Okay,
there you go.
I was like, oh, there's my other
car. I pulled
car.
Up and I was like, she could be in either of these, but this definitely looks like a Luke mobile.
Yes.
It's got all the hunting stuff on it, so... maybe a little bit about that, about your family and your time in Alaska, because it's a very cool part of the book of how that plays into it, both for the drama and then the background.
Yeah. So I'll jump back to Anna's story. So, because Luke fishes in Alaska, and because I'd had a C-section with my firstborn, I didn't want to fly up to Sitka to have my secondborn, because they would have, I called them and they were like, you can't have her naturally here, the baby naturally here. You're going to have to schedule a C-section. And for me, that was just a hard recovery. I was like, when Luke is fishing, so he's a salmon fisherman in Sitka, which is an island in Southeast Alaska. There's one hospital there. And I was like, I'm not going to go up there, recover from major surgery while he fishes 7 days a week. And so I stayed behind to have Anna, and we knew that I would just call him when I went into labor, but that he would likely miss it, because there's like three flights off the island. It's a mountainous island. It's kind of like Hawaii plus a ton of rain and fog. So it's really beautiful, but you have to like wait for the beauty there. Sure. It's not a given. It's earned. You wait sometimes 20 or 30 days of rain and fog to even see the mountain range. So... this story is becoming very long. But I called him. He flew back. He didn't make it for her labor. But, you know, I was still in the hospital when he got here. And I was like, she's really quiet. Like, she's, you know, she's not making sounds. She's alert. She's small, but something's up. So he had to fly back to Alaska. So he left. The plan was for my mom and my toddler and the newborn and me to fly to Sitka at the end of that coming week. So I took Anna to the pediatrician the day before we were supposed to fly to Alaska with my mom. And he said, okay, she's small. She didn't pass her hearing test. Let's test her for this common but little known virus, if you're up for it. It's called CMV. And you know, I'm a reader. I had read all the prenatal literature. I was like, this is rare. She probably doesn't have it. If it's a virus, probably not what we're looking at. And the hearing technicians in the hospital had said, she's really small. It's probably just fluid in her ears and she'll pass the test when you bring her back in a week. Deep down, I was like, no, she won't. I just had this, this weird internal knowledge. And, so I said, sure, you can test her as long as it's fast. I need to go pack my bags, you know, we're leaving. And the doctor was like, if she has it, I think you should be with your husband when you find out. And that was really gracious of him and the right thing for us, at least. And so they just, they attached what the nurse called a potty purse to her hips. It's just a little clear bag, and she peed into it and it went to the lab. So I did fly up there with my mom and the girls the next day. And Alaska for me is this place of like severe beauty and severe isolation. Mm-hmm. I have grown to love certain things about it, but it's just not my place. You know, I'm from Colorado, so sun is my thing. Like it makes me happy. Right. When it's gone, I'm not as happy. And it's taken me many years. We have some very close friends there, but it's just lonelier. And when you're seasonal somewhere, you're not a part of the fabric of life the same way you are. And that's definitely the case. you know, parish wise there. We're just like visitors in the parish. We don't have the home that we have here in the Eastern Church. And there is not an Eastern Catholic Church there. There's a Roman Catholic Church, and then there's the Orthodox Church. And we kind of go to both. We go to the Orthodox Church for Vespers, and we're good friends with a family there who, he's the pastor, and they're actually in the book. And so I get up to this place that is kind of this place where I always have the most problems. And I get the phone call that Anna does have this disease called congenital CMV. And so congenital means from birth. And that means that I had caught this virus when I was pregnant with her. Now, in the interim between, you know, them testing her for it and us flying up there, I, of course, Googled it. And I was totally taken aback because CMV is actually the leading cause of birth defects. And it's the leading cause of deafness, if it's non-genetic deafness. And it's contagious in the saliva of one out of three toddlers. Hmm. And obstetricians do not want mothers to know about it. And I was like, what is this? How is this even possible that in today's day and age, this information is being kept from women and it's disabling? It's a disabling pathogen. It's actually the leading pathogen linked to stillbirth as well. And so as I was researching and just like digging up like just mountains of buried knowledge and research, I was like, I had written quite a bit before that. I have my MFA in nonfiction, and I had always heard like, you know, God will just drop the book into your hands that you're made to write, whether you want to or not. And there it was. And so when we got her diagnosis, and, you know, sat with it for a couple of days, and I went to the library and I would just look out at the sea and these dark mountains and this forest. And just, I felt this like aloneness, but also this real comfort in the beauty there and this ability that I would be able to spend time, you know, in this library with when Luke was home, when my mom was there, babysitters, whatever, and given enough time, I would need to make a book of this because I just felt that women deserved this truth.
Mm-hmm. And this has been, well, the last line in the book, not to give it away, but I wanted to mention it, but you said, I don't know if you were quoting somebody or you were just saying this, but that there's no act more therapeutic than asking someone to share their story.
Yeah. That's a quote.
That was a quote from
somebody else. Yeah. Her name's Dr. Suzanne Coven.
Okay,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Letter to a Young Female Physician that is really about, and this is what my book became about, was really looking at medicine and how to make it more humane, especially because I believe CMV, Anna's disease, presents this opportunity to make all of medicine better. And what's missing, I realized through the writing of it, you know, like 6 years into it, that I wasn't just talking about the missing narrative of CMV in medicine. I was seeing this drastic absence of narrative in general in medicine, and that the way that people are healed is by telling their stories, and that, you know, and that's our church too. Like through stories, we find meaning. That is what the Bible is. And for me, you know, there was no literature about CMV. There was no story. I was not introduced to another family who had a child disabled by it. Mm. And so I felt, and somebody at some point said, a gift to the world is the one that it doesn't yet have. And like, as a writer, it was the book that had not been written about CMV. I wanted a mother's story about CMV, and there wasn't one. And so that became, you know, my vocation.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And it really does feel like that. I mean, even today you were just at, was it Children's Hospital you were mentioning, mm-hmm. or recently there's been some legislation stuff that you've been working on.
Yeah.
So I hope you can catch us up on that, but sure. Just to pause for a second and just note that, story becomes kind of the first category, I think, for the spiritual interpretation of what is happening here, your experience, and then your ability as a writer to communicate that. So number one, then the need for narrative to be recovered in medicine, mm-hmm. which I think is really central. And because it's not just CMV awareness, it definitely is, but it's also like we're missing this because we're not caring for stories.
Right.
We're not actually mm-hmm. talking to people, and they need, and then this story does also communicate, the narrative actually mm-hmm. does deliver the message, which is that this needs to, we need awareness on this. And I do want to ask you about that. And then the second kind of layer of that is the way that the incarnation, which is the center of the Catholic worldview, which is a story, and that God communicates through story. Mm-hmm. And that this is, and that even somebody, these publishers at Penguin or Doubleday or whatever, I forget which one it was, but they got that. Mm-hmm. They were like, this resonated yeah. with them. And that's humanity. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're always preoccupied with is just like, how do we, things are so crazy right now in this technological world, but and they're getting more polarized, getting more extreme. And we're worried about the Catholic experience losing its human dimension. Mm-hmm. And I think what resonated for me, and I'm sure for Sean and what he read, was just like, you really present an authentically human experience of faith, but also of engaging suffering in that. And I think it's centered around that notion of story or narrative. So it just dovetailed well with your vocation.
Yeah, I would agree. I think all of us probably can get so like bogged down by like these dense theological books or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, sometimes we pick up books.
I don't, but like, I'm sure you guys do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The manuscript tradition or whatever it is. Right. And we get bogged down by that. And when I first looked at the title, I'm like, oh, Remedies for Sorrow. Like immediately this is going to be about Aquinas, whatever. But you open up like the first, you know, many pages. I mean, it takes a long time before you even get there, which I actually felt, to Father John's point, like very happy about, because it's just like, you can't understand that until you understand the full story, right? Mm-hmm. And you had a profound way of sharing that, of inviting people to enter into this and to say, the therapeutic nature of telling that story and then drawing people in and saying like, well, this is how I dealt with it, you know, the suffering, and here's the remedies for it, which is really profound. But it starts with story, absolutely.
And it starts with feeling, right? I mean, I am a German. You're also Nix. Mm-hmm. Father David Nix is her brother, and he's an old friend. And we used to, David in Hebrew means beloved, and Nix in German means nothing. So yeah. We'd always refer to him as beloved nothingness.
It can also mean sea beast.
Sea beast? Really?
I didn't Nix, know that. Yeah.
Nix.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's actually, N-I-X is not nothingness, but that was our Nix.
Or the lice medicine.
The lice medicine?
Yeah,
really?
Nix. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I've never had lice. Wouldn't know.
Oh, one of my daughters had it in Sitka. Not good.
Oh, yeah. We just had a guy come back from Peru.
Ooh, with lice?
I won't name his
name.
With
bed bugs.
No, with lice.
Ooh.
It's really, it's gnarly. A horrible affliction.
But that being said, you, and this is to your point, Sean, is that you have to start with feeling, like, mm-hmm. and you draw the reader into the story, into the mm-hmm. narrative by what the Greeks called pathos, of just like, right. there's emotion here. Mm-hmm. And that's because we all want the remedy. We want the quick fix. Mm-hmm. You found yourself in the situation, with a daughter who was impaired because of a disease that you contracted because you weren't aware of this. And so I just feel like there was so many levels to that mm-hmm. that you had to sort through emotionally. I'm not going to speak yeah. for you, but mm-hmm. I just feel like you presented that instead of kind of jumping to, here's the quick fix.
Yeah.
Here's how you get the remedy for your sorrow. Here's how you take away and we medicate it.
Or anger. Like I feel like in the publishing industry right now, anger is the driver for so many books. And I don't know why people read those. Like, who wants to see just like female rage? That's like a trending book topic. Mm. And I purposely didn't try to publish the book within a year because I was still angry. And that just feels like, you know, I mean, anger is very natural. That's fine. But there's an immaturity to that that I needed to live through and figure out, you know, what the book was actually about and what else I was feeling both in the beginning and after, you know, getting to know Anna. So it turned out, we found out a month after getting to Sitka that she is profoundly deaf. So she cannot hear at all. The audiologist, I had to fly down to Seattle with her, and they said she would not hear a jet engine if she were standing next to it, is wow. her level of hearing loss. And that was just such foreign territory. I mean, it was sorrow and grief and anger and confusion. And it's so interesting because now we don't see her deafness that way at all. It's actually a gift. And that was sort of woven into our spirituality as well. Sort of looking at the history of silence in the church and thinking about it in terms of prayer. And I forget where I was going, but she, yeah, I think, what were you saying a minute ago?
I don't even know, but that was really good. So two questions for you. Is sign language a part of your family?
Oh
life?
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was going to say, since you know that she has heard me on the radio, cause I just said that. So she did end up, we did get her cochlear implants, and that was a very emotional choice for me. Not so much for Luke. He's very rational. Mm-hmm. But I like really thought into it and perseverated over our choice because we wanted to honor that she was congenitally deaf and that God made her without sound. And yet we are a hearing family and there is this technology that's incredible. Cochlear implants are surgically embedded. They bypass the ear entirely. They're not like hearing aids that amplify sound. They actually send a radio wave straight into the brain. So like today, Anna, if you're on an airplane with her and she's watching a movie on an iPad, she hears it directly in her brain and nobody hears it next to her. Or if she uses Bluetooth on my phone to talk to somebody, underwater, she can hear through her cochlear implants. If I'm wearing a microphone, it's just like a little clip that goes on my collar. She can hear me 10 feet underwater. So it's this really cool technology, but we also love that she can revert to silence anytime. She can take them off. And we also did, in Colorado, there's a free program here where a deaf adult works with your family every week for 6 years. They come over. Hmm. And so our deaf tutor, her name's Kathy, she became like a family member and we learned ASL with her. And when I was pregnant with our third child, I found out that St. Bernadette's parish here is a deaf correct parish, and yep, they have a priest who is fluent in ASL. Mm-hmm. And we went there and it was just so beautiful. I mean, the whole thing is spoken and signed. Mm-hmm. And so it was just this beautiful moment that was like, she'll be included here too, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's beautiful. Let's go back to CMV for a minute. I don't want to panic our moms listening, our friends who are pregnant, but we do want to. I do want to give you the opportunity to just say a little bit more about mm-hmm. like what have you learned, and what's your kind of elevator pitch on like it can be more than that, but like just awareness mm-hmm. without panic, but just be prudential and be a bit more thoughtful on such and such.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the goal, is to not, you know, terrify women, because this has always existed. So actually knowing about it greatly reduces your risk of contracting it in itself. So some people are like, I wish I never knew. A very small amount of people feel that way. Most people are like, I'm glad to know this, because if you're pregnant just during those 9 months, you should try to not finish your toddler's snacks. I know that was totally my go-to. I didn't cook. I just ate their food. Not kiss them on the lips. Kiss them on the top of the head when you're pregnant. And don't let them use your toothbrush. You know, so CMV is never airborne, so there's no need to mask, which is awesome. And, you know, it's just sort of like natural stuff. Like, especially now, like, now we know, you know, when I was pregnant with Anna, there was sort of that myth of like, oh, if you catch the cold, it'll give the baby antibodies. Mm. Now we're more like, don't get the germs of other people. But so it's really these simple hygienic measures, universal precautions, basically, because CMV is in the saliva of toddlers and mothers are home with their toddlers. That's why moms are high risk of contracting it. So are childcare workers. So people who run in-home daycare centers or whose kids are in daycare. So this is kind of a scary statistic, but it is the truth. 80% of children in daycare will have a CMV infection within 2 years. Oh. And that's, so CMV, there's two types of CMV. CMV infection is just like a common cold. 50 to 80% of the population in the U.S. has had it by the time they're 40. And it's fine if you're, you know, an infant, if you're a toddler, if you're an adult, totally fine. Only if you've had an organ transplant is it dangerous. But if you're pregnant and you get it, that's a different impact because the baby is rapidly developing in utero. Mm-hmm. And so that's when it becomes congenital CMV, when it crosses the placenta. And for some reason, CMV is just weird. When adults have it, they get rid of it in their saliva and urine within like a week. But toddlers will shed it contagiously for up to 40 months. So, and there's, beautifully, there's no need and no good way to test toddlers for it because they can be positive one day and negative the next. So we are not going to have this like crazy hype around it and, you know, like, you know, COVID type measures around CMV ever because it's just not the same type of disease. But if you have a toddler, you should know that. And the studies show that you can reduce your risk of contracting CMV during pregnancy by 70% if you just try to not get their saliva in your mouth and wash your hands well after wiping their nose or whatever. And it's not perfect. But the point is, like, if this exists and it disables kids, so CMV causes deafness, blindness, cerebral palsy, autism. Did I say epilepsy?
Mm-mm.
Epilepsy, stillbirth, and early infant death. So it is like this haunting spectrum of issues. And the obstetrical community has said, ACOG, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, tells their providers, we don't want you to discuss this with pregnant women because this information would be impractical and burdensome, which is just so incapacitating of people who are at the greatest capacity of a human being in their lifetime. They are full of life, and mothers will do everything to protect that life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really saw it just as this betrayal of our devotion to our children to you know, prohibit us from knowing this when, look, it happens. Like, now that Anna has CMV, I see it all the time. Like, one of our neighbors has a child who's, well, she's 37 now, but she is profoundly disabled by CMV. She is ventilator dependent. She's deaf. She's nonverbal. And you will find these kids. And there are, so the real tragedy is that only about 10% are ever even diagnosed who have CMV. And there's treatment right after birth. So Anna was able to get on this antiviral that prevents brain damage, and it can also stop progressive hearing loss. And so I won't go into, like, you know, everything. That's why I wrote a book. And it does get sort of complex. But if you're pregnant and you see abnormalities on ultrasound, it is worth asking your doctor to test you for CMV. Testing during pregnancy is not perfect. And I would not recommend that all pregnant women get tested for CMV, because it's just not a reliable testing form, and there's not a great treatment during pregnancy. Really, it's just knowledge. And then afterwards, if your baby fails a hearing test, if they are small, if they have a small head size, you should request that they are tested for CMV. In Colorado, we just passed this legislation that if any of those three things happen, that baby is immediately tested for CMV. There's a couple states where they're testing all newborns for CMV because they can be asymptomatic, and they often are. So, you know, if you have a baby who looks healthy, but the mom had CMV during pregnancy and that baby's not tested, they can go on to lose their hearing by the age of 3 or 4. Wow. So really that testing is important because of the hearing loss, because that baby is not really at risk of disabilities, but they're at risk of quietly losing their hearing and their parents not knowing and not intervening with hearing aids or sign language or whatever they choose. And, you know, getting that early identification helps the parents to know their child and to have those audiological checkups so that they know that they're at risk. So really, like, so women know about toxoplasmosis, which is the kitty litter disease. Don't go near kitty litter when you're pregnant. That affects 1 in 10,000 babies. CMV infects 1 in 200. So it really should be known, and we should be telling couples to know about this. So,
well, yeah. Congratulations on that legislation. I know that's been something you've been working at. So,
and we'll go on to lobby for universal testing here, because at this legislation, it was awesome. We were at the Board of Health 2 weeks ago, and a bunch of us testified, and then the panel was like, this seems so obvious. Why aren't we just testing all babies for this? Right. And we were like, yes, that's exactly what we wanted you to take away from this. So it just seems like common sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think most Catholics know, like, the OB world just tends to be so driven by forces that are not life-giving. Mm-hmm. And I deeply feel that this is, and that it preserves the potential of a child for the parents to know about this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really profound. I was shocked when I read in the book, and you just said it as well, that a lot of stillbirths can be because of CMV, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, obviously you figured out about CMV after Anna was diagnosed, but what about people who might have had a stillbirth and then mm-hmm. they might be hearing this and they're like, did I make a mistake? Am I a bad mother because I didn't know about this and I haven't done my research, I haven't done my homework, I haven't done mm-hmm. whatever. Do you have any thoughts on, like, I was going to ask this later, but maybe now as well, of like miscarriage and like how this mm-hmm. plays into the remedies of sorrow. But right now, more specifically, like, am I a bad mother if I don't know about this mm-hmm. and I have a child with a disability?
Yeah, no, definitely not. Of course. And it's been linked to miscarriage too. I mean, you know, that's sort of just, you know, inherently it probably is involved with a lot more of these intrauterine problems than anybody even knows. And miscarriage is one of them. But no, interestingly, I never felt guilt. A lot of CMV moms that I know really struggle with that, like needed therapy. Like, I did this to them. I didn't know. I immediately felt, how could I have known? Nobody told me. Like, you can't just conjure the name of a disease and its location mm-hmm. of your own accord. If a prenatal clinic, you know, had told me that CMV existed and I had, like, repeatedly kissed my child on the lips, then I might feel guilty. But I'm sure these mothers had no knowledge of it. And that is, like, that's also an effect of not disclosing this information, is that there are mothers who have lost their children who bear that guilt, and it's not their fault. It really, I think it's a void in medicine that really needs to be addressed, and that it's, you might exercise those precautions and your child might still have CMV. And that ended up, you know, the grief that we initially felt does not really exist in us anymore. I think when your child dies from CMV, that's a very different path than we're on, obviously. But that CMV, paradoxically, even though I'm fighting to prevent more cases of it, the children who have it are absolutely remarkable. And a lot of the book I spent with these families who had children who, some have 17 diagnoses with CMV, who have every possible symptom. And they are just incredible forces of love and compassion and charity. Mm-hmm. And I think these kids offer something to the world that is generally discounted or not seen very well by the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners who have kids who are different feel that very deeply, that those children are cherished in a different way and have changed them and their families and their faith.
Right.
And most likely, I mean, the families that I know, it is a deepening of all things to have a child who, you know, has these differences.
Mm.
I love the subtitle or the subsections of the book. So the book is divided into 5 parts, and Megan describes it like this: weeping, contemplation, company, pleasure, and caretaking. And I just think that from a spiritual perspective, passing through those stages with any suffering is probably integral in some way to arriving at what you just described, which is to see in suffering the gift, to find the deeper meaningfulness of things and love. But could you talk a little bit about that and Aquinas's influence in particular on the book?
Yeah. He had very little.
He had some great quotes, though.
I just put his quotes in there. Yeah. He's too hard for me to read. So I liked his idea. When I went to the Summa Theologia, how do you say that?
That's good. Is that right?
Yeah. That's
right. Yep. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not reading this. This is crazy. How do people read this? Do you guys read that?
It's like eating concrete for breakfast. Right.
We read it in seminary. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's so legalistic. You know, it's all defenses of arguments. And it's just, luckily, the Remedies for Sorrow takes about 5 minutes to read. Mm-hmm. It's just this, like, two columns of these prescriptive treatments for the human condition of sorrow. And when I read them, I started to think about, did I do that? Did I feel this? And it was so true to my experience. So the weeping, you know, was just a natural initial response. You know, I just cried all over the place. I cried initially hearing her diagnosis. I cried in the shower. I cried making dinner. I cried on Luke's boat. And I'm just a crier. So that one was sort of easy, and it really like just fit into the book in terms of like just the sorrow of our loss of our idea of what things would be like. And then the contemplation of the truth seemed to fit so well, because here I am looking at the truth being shrouded by the industry that is supposed to keep us safe. And I was looking at the truth of suffering, you know, and what is its purpose, and how do we answer to this as Catholics? And then company was others, you know, friendship is what St. Thomas Aquinas says, the company of friends is healing. And that was certainly the case. And at that point in the narrative is when I did start to meet these other families whose kids had CMV, and I began to see it, not as a hindrance, but as like a opportunity for growth, really, and a fruitfulness in their families that I wanted to strive for in ours. And then pleasure. What does he say? The things that we love make us who we are, I think is what Aquinas says. And at that point in the writing of it, I was a little bit at a loss. I was like, this is the point in the writing where it's really supposed to be like the rising action and the climax, and then it, you know, comes down to the resolution. And and
the things that we love tell us what we are.
Yeah. And I realized it was my children, you know, and that I just needed to write that part about like Anna at that point in time. And then this medicine part, this medical reform really came into the book at that point, because I was seeing that like I loved to be able to tell our story, and that I wasn't really allowed that in these very fast doctor's appointments. And there was this one doctor here who stopped in front of a whole crowd of people and said to me, what didn't we do that we should have? Mm-hmm. And I just found it so humbling. And this broke open this field for me called narrative medicine, where doctors, you know, they shrink their practice down so that they can work with fewer patients, so that they can spend time hearing their story. And the beautiful thing is that doctors are allowed to become writers. They can write in poetry or prose, and they don't chart in the normal way. They actually become, you know, a vessel for that person's story, and they discover things about themselves and their patient that they didn't know until that point. And statistically, people are much more likely to stick with that doctor, to follow the treatment regimen. They have alleviation of symptoms. They don't seek a second opinion. Anyways, and then the fifth remedy is actually, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, is a warm bath and a nap. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't make a whole chapter of my book on me like taking a nap. But I took that. And of course, like I took creative license to sort of shape each chapter according to his remedies, but I found them very accurate and very applicable. They had been a part of my life. And the fifth one was really more about like caretaking, like that when we physically care for the body, obviously, then our spiritual selves are healthier, and that we have to do that in medicine. Like we can't treat people like we do in this throwaway culture and expect medicine to function properly. And everybody can tell you it's not functioning very well. Mm-hmm. And so that ended up, you know, being the culmination of the book. And then as the book came out, I have this new sorrow and of my mom dying. And a journalist that was interviewing me, she said, well, now that you've written it, do you think those remedies apply? Because like Anna still lived. So like you had initial sorrow, but she's thriving. She really is thriving. She's doing great. And she said, do these remedies work in the light of death, or, you know, in light of your mom's death? And I thought about it, and I think they really do. And I think about them too when grief sneaks in, you know, and it's just sort of unexpected. And I think, you know, what of these can I put to use, or what am I doing that feels like it's not helping me, but maybe is? Crying, you know, or seeking friends. And, you know, sometimes pleasure feels almost like a betrayal of grief and a distance from the person you've lost to move on and to find yourself enjoying something. But it shouldn't, you know, it's necessary to keep living and mm-hmm. to keep, you know, finding those things that bring joy and hope.
Can you talk about the kind of interplay of like, there's still the sorrow that maybe you even still experience now? Of course, Anna's thriving and doing well, it sounds like, but there's probably still days where it's just like, I wish she could hear fully. I don't know, maybe you have that, maybe not. But like for any sort of grief, there's still going to be moments where I'm still mourning. I'm still mm-hmm. weeping. I'm still contemplating. I need that hot bath, right? Or whatever it is. But then there's moments where I get out of that and come back to the joy. But is it kind of up and down still, or how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, I think people who grieve, somebody said, I mean, there's like a million analogies for grief. I bet there's more analogies for grief than like any other mm-hmm. word in the English language. But somebody said to me after my mom died that it's like waves that at first, you know, the frequency and intensity are extreme, and the intensity doesn't go away, but the frequency does. And I do feel that, like, and it's just a sneaky thing. Like, you'll be fine, and then you just have this intense hold on your loss that comes out of nowhere. It's like you remember it. You're just so connected to it that you couldn't believe you could have been okay for a couple days. And I think, you know, Aquinas is not suggesting that we can eradicate sorrow, nor would we want to. If we, you know, lived in Candyland, there'd be no need for God. And we would just be totally complacent, as many are, you know. But that has its a grief of its own. When you live disconnected from grief, there's a deep sadness that you probably can't even identify necessarily. So I think grief, I just read this book, I talked to you about it, Father John. It's so interesting. It's an interview with Nick Cave, who's this rock musician who was like this just crazy man. I mean, like heroin addict, like crazy partying and international traveling. And his son died in, I think, might have been 2019. And then a second son of his died recently as well. And he writes about grief as this force that we could use to either turn inward or turn outward. And that in his life, and so his music went from being this like dark, almost demonic force into all religious songs. And he has these interviews on stage. It's called In Conversation, where people ask him about his grief. And he just felt very compelled to change the world with it. And he said it recreated him and his wife. And I do feel like that. Like grief makes life, you know, I think feeling fragility makes you live with a different precision and engagement and sometimes a different kind of withdrawal and sadness. But I think, you know, I'm surprised how functioning I am, even though I'm as sad as I was when my mom first died. And I think you know, there's an imperative to go to people when you feel that kind of loss. Mm. And if you don't, then it's, you're sort of stranded, you know?
Right. Yeah. And alone, you know?
I have one last question for you. We are at an hour, so we probably need to kind of wrap this thing up. We could talk to you all day. It's way more interesting. But just being a woman who's Eastern Catholic, and you and I spoke a little bit about this, but if, I just feel like dealing with the suffering and the sorrow around silence in particular, and in a Christian tradition, Catholic tradition that is just more in tune with silence and mystery, there's a sense of the apophatic, which means kind of the unknowing, mm-hmm. unknowability of things, mm-hmm. of God even.
Yeah.
You mentioned Hesed is a theme kind of woven into the book. And then I always get the word wrong. Hesychia.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you have any particular thoughts just on how the distinctiveness of your Byzantine faith came to bear on the kind of spiritual engagement with this suffering.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Eastern theology is, like you said, the essence of God, it's okay for it to be unknowable. In Eastern theology, there's like energies of God that are very detectable and feelable on earth, you know, through other people, through music, but the essence of him can never be fully known. And this Hesychia is, so this Orthodox family in Sitka that we know, they're very quiet. They're also Yupik, and Yupik people don't talk a lot. They do not say what doesn't need to be said, which is very foreign for, you know, I could talk forever. And I sort of saw just Hesychia in their family, which is this inner stillness. It's a comfort with inner stillness and with silence. And that, that, you know, reaching that deep level of prayer depends upon that sort of abdicating of the senses, which I thought was so beautiful, finding that out after having Anna, that like, sometimes the deepest place of prayer is like a place of deafness where you are absent one or more of the senses. And I didn't really, you know, growing up Roman Catholic, prayer does happen in silence, but it didn't quite have the spiritual power that it did to me when I saw it sort of more specifically in the Eastern framework of the liturgy, where there is a lot more silence. Like in Lent, there's a point where the priest walks in with the light of Christ, and you prostrate and you lay on the ground in silence until he has come all the way from the back of the church to the front. So there is this like humbling into silence where you feel things differently, you know, this posture of giving yourself to something that is outside of you. I think is really beautifully articulated in the Eastern Church. And then Hesed is, well, you might, you know, I don't know Hesed as well as some do. I'm in that in Ipso class with Father Hellstrom right now. Okay. And he speaks about it very articulately. But it's basically like the way that I understood it was that it's this combination of like loving kindness and mm-hmm. mercy that compels one. I mean, it's like God's love covenant with us that compelled him to make us and to give us the good things that we have. But that as humans, when we exercise, it's like chesed is how you actually say it. It's like a sense of love and mercy so great that you act and that you are contributing something of greatness mm-hmm. to the world. And that could be motherhood. It can be, and it could be little things, you know, like St. Therese of Lisieux. It doesn't have to be something great in terms of achievement, but that you are compelled in life to give something that will bring significance to others.
Yeah. Yeah. Hesed is a very powerful verb. One of our buddies, a Protestant pastor, Vern, he has a big tattoo on the back of his calf that just says Hesed on
I need a picture of it.
Which I love.
I didn't know that.
He does, yeah. Next time you go biking with him, take a look at his calf. But it's one of the Eucharistic prayers. I think it's number two. Don't quote me on that. But I always get struck by the line where it says, and grant in your loving kindness. Hmm. I don't remember what it says after that. But your loving kindness. Like if we were to translate that into Hebrew, I've always wondered, is that the word hesed there? Mm-hmm. Mercy, loving kindness. It's a very powerful dynamic. And Hebrew is a very dynamic language in the sense of like Shema is the same word, right? Hear, O Israel. It's not just like hear, but obey my commandments. It calls something out of you. And Hesed's the same way. Like God is all merciful, but then when we have that loving kindness, like it demands something out of us.
Yeah. And the other word that I didn't know, and like speaking of revising, you know, up till 3 years after it was published, that I just found out from Father Hellstrom is rahamin, which means womb love, which is exactly why this book, you know, that was what I felt for Anna. And that is what I feel for, you know, other pregnant women, even, you know, just like that. You guys might not have any idea what I'm talking about, but you can appreciate it from afar. Yeah, but it is, there is a poverty in English, you know, for some of these really rich human experiences of God's love. And I love those words.
Yeah, well, and these words are absolutely central to the Pentateuch's description of God. So those first couple books of the Old Testament, Hesed is the quality of God.
Correct.
It establishes the covenant. All of salvation history, circling back to the notion of narrative, it's a narrative of Hesed. And the depth of this language, womb-like love, I mean, this really is the heart of everything. And we've just lost that, I think, in a sense. And that's why In Ipso is this beautiful program, Spiritual Formation in Prayer, that Father Hellstrom does here in Denver. The silence, as I was thinking about what you were saying about just our own deafness towards God. I mean, this is something we could talk about for a long time, but the Father's silence, apart for three different times when he speaks, but Jesus is the word of the Father, but the Father is that unknowable origin of the Trinitarian life, and the East just has a deep reverence and a sense for that. So it's beautiful the way it's translated into your life and manifests in this story. So.
Yeah, it reminds me of... this book called Let Me See Your Face, Let Me Hear Your Voice, which I'll have to find. I can't remember the author's name, but I can recommend that to you. Because this lady has a child with autism, and she uses the word, I need to recover my child from autism, that I can, so that he can hear my voice and see my face, right? Kids with autism, they hide. They can't make eye contact and whatnot. It's this beautiful story of a mother who, like, rescues her child in that way. But let me hear your voice, let me see your face is a quotation from Song of Songs. And then Patricia Snow has a great article on this where she says in a certain sense, like, we're all autistic before God. Like, none of us know how to look him in the eye, none of us know how to, like, sit before him, especially in that silence. Like, we're so afraid to be in that position, but to be able to just sit back and receive and just, like, okay, Lord, like, I don't know what you're doing, but here I am, and I'll walk with you in the sorrow, in the weeping, in the crying.
Yeah, I love that. I really found that in these families who had children who would be seen as helpless, like their receptivity, you know, their passion, their like handing over of their lives was more affecting of people around them than anything I'd ever seen. And they were fully receptive. To love and to acts of mercy. And I just think we don't think about that. You know, we think about it as like being disabled, but there's a real importance, you know, in the spiritual life of like taking that as a lesson and seeing that that's, you know, heroic in its way to be, because we will all reach these points that we are, you know, either temporarily disabled or permanently in the end. And because of our cultural valuing of doing over being, people deeply reject that phase. And I think there's a lot to look at with children who willingly both receive love and engender, you know, this merciful love around them.
Beautiful. Okay. We got to wrap it up. Do you have any final thoughts or any shout outs you'd like to make
before
we conclude?
Oh, I'd like to shout out my St. Peter and Paul mom friends.
All right.
My besties and my family and Luke.
Do you know the Shepherds by any chance?
Oh, yeah. We love the Shepherds. Ariel. Yes. Shout out to Ariel and Brent.
Ariel and Brent.
Savannah and London and
That's
Vienna.
Great.
Hope they're listening. They're great.
That's good people. Yeah. Thank you again. Shawnee, you got any?
Thank you, guys. You guys are awesome.
Any last thoughts or any shout-outs?
I'm done with your thoughts. Give me a shout-out.
I have plenty of last thoughts. Shout-outs. I would just like to shout-out the Daly family, who this was actually really beautiful for me to read. I was walking with the Daly family, and they're open about this. So I think they're okay with me sharing this. But they lost their 19-year-old daughter last year, and I had the gift of kind of walking with them. And it was through cancer, and it was just really sad and really hard. But mm-hmm. Megan, their mother, she's been reading a lot of Remedies for Sorrow, so I'm going to recommend this book to her. But it just made me think, reading this book, of them and the beautiful gift of how it formed my heart to walk with people in their suffering. So shout out to them, Deacon Mike and Megan.
I'm going to stop giving shout outs. I'm just going to give what the Italians call errati. So when you give a dissertation, you go to your defense, they just publish at the bottom all of the mistakes. Errati. And that's what every podcast this
Errors.
Spring has had
yes.
to be. So the most recent error is apparently Dr. Huberman is a Christian, and I threw him under the bus as a Stoic.
Oh no!
2 weeks ago. So Kevin Donahue, my friend up in Kalispell, Montana, was like, great podcast, by the way, he's Christian. So there are other people. We got a lot of interesting feedback from that podcast.
Bourbon, yeah.
A lot of all our bourbon friends kind of came out and said, yes, you know. We stand together in this cause, but it stirred a lot of conversation, and I just want to put that out there of like what we're riffing on about the way that Stoicism is resonating and but kind of mimics the Christian thing. We're getting there, and so hopefully we'll kind of keep the podcast going. And but in the meantime, I hope not to slander anybody anymore on that. So, well, Shawnee, this concludes part one of the three trimesters, of the year. So as we've mentioned to people, we're going to be recording with one other guy for 3 months, 4 months at a time. So this concludes our recording for the year. So I'll see you in 2025.
Great.
Hopefully
look forward to it.
Hopefully before then. A couple bike rides.
At least.
In the meantime. Yes. So we'll have all the guys together every once in a while, podcasting like in August, like we do every year. But you're going to be with Jacob through the summer, soon to be Father Jacob Machado.
That's right.
In fact, you'll probably start with him right as he's being ordained, which
in
is
May,
crazy.
Yeah, May 4th is our first. No, not May 4th. Anyways, May 9th, somewhere around there is our first episode.
Okay, yeah, so right before the ordination. So pray for soon to be Father Jacob Machado, and then I'm going to be with Father Michael Lawrence Rapp, of course, the wild man, through the summer. We'll see if we get anything recorded. We'll be working on that, but Megan Nix, thank you again.
Thank you, yes.
I know you have a website, just meganix.com,
mm-hmm.
So they can learn more there. Yeah. Audiobook, it's available.
Yeah, it's on Audible. And yeah, if you just look up Remedies for Sorrow, it's on, it's published by Doubleday, and it's on Amazon and in bookstores and in the library sometimes, but people are reading it, so.
That's great. Well, we're going to put a link in the show notes for this, and it's just great to have you.
Thanks so much.
So thanks for your wonderful work and for being with us.
Father
Sean, I will talk to you soon.
Great.
So this is at Catholic Stuff You Should Know. What is it?
Catholic Stuff Podcast at gmail.com.
There you go. It's only the 700th time we've done that. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.